This is the Bama Podcast with Marty Solomon. I'm his co-host, Brent Billings. Today, I'm with Reed Dent to hear the voice of Psalm 19.
You and me, back at it. Just the two of us this time.
Just the two of us. I wasn't even remotely close to the melody.
No, that's good. You sound good. That's not even going to be a blooper. We're going to keep that right up top.
Sure.
Welcome back to the Psalms, everyone. Briggs. Let me start that over. I'm going to start this over.
Today is Briggs' birthday as this episode releases.
That's true. This is releasing on Briggs' birthday. Happy birthday, Briggs. But what I was going to actually say, what I wanted to say was Brent said, let's do Psalm 19 because Brent loves Psalm 19 for reasons that we're going to discover. So Brent, you have the majority of the notes here. I'm going to kind of put the steering wheel in your hands and you're going to steer and I'm going to just be along. I'm going to drive from the back seat. I'm going to chirp over your shoulder and be like, don't go that way, that way. No, that's actually not what I'm going to do. I'm going to just, we're on a nice Sunday afternoon drive with the top down and I'm in the passenger seat just seeing where it is you're going to take me.
Okay. Well, in the spirit of me being in charge here, why don't you read Psalm 19?
Oh, snap! I was not ready for that. I, of course, would love to do that because, as you know, one of my favorite things is to read aloud to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. All right. Okay. Man, this feels like such an honor to take the spot of reading the text. Holy cow, Brent. Okay.
Well, part of it is that I do think about this psalm all the time. And so I have a pretty deep rut of the way that I read this. And so I just kind of want to hear somebody else read it.
That's fair. That makes sense. Okay. Here we go. Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. In the heavens, God has pitched a tent for the sun. It is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is deprived of its warmth. The law of the Lord is perfect, refreshing the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The decrees of the Lord are firm, and all of them are righteous. They are more precious than gold, than much pure gold. They are sweeter than honey from the honeycomb. By them your servant is warned. In keeping them there is great reward, but who can discern their own errors? Forgive my hidden faults. Keep your servant also from willful sins. May they not rule over me. Then I will be blameless, innocent of great transgression. May these words of my mouth and this meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, Lord, my rock and my redeemer.
That was perfect.
How'd I do?
You emphasized the exact opposite of all the things that I emphasize. Like in the first half, in the first part, I should say, because in word count, the two halves are quite lopsided. But the first part, you emphasize the relentless nature of what's happening. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. And I'm the opposite. I'm like, day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. And just like, I'm just like out in the clouds. Maybe for obvious reasons. But then in the second half, I'm like, ugh, the law, the statutes, the precepts, like what? It's all the same. And you're like, no, each one is unique. The law of the Lord is perfect. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy. So like You did exactly what I needed you to do.
Yeah. Heck yeah. Okay. I love that. That was experiment just totally on the fly. We did not prepare that. I hope listeners hear by my initial reaction, I really did not know I was going to be reading that. So that's excellent.
Yeah. I intentionally sprung that on you. Fitting with our whole framework for this entire series, orientation, disorientation, or reorientation, what do you think?
I think this has got to be an orientation psalm. What I think is really interesting about it is, and this I'm sure we're going to be talking about this, is that what is orienting to the psalmist is both equally and kind of paralleled the creation and then the law, the statutes, the precepts, that both of these things are orienting in the life of the psalmist.
Yeah, this almost feels like it's pre-fall. Like, obviously, there's a little bit later on sins and errors and whatever, transgressions. Like, there's, you know, this is a post-Genesis 3 thing. Like, there is an awareness of that, but it's like, it's almost like you're back in the garden and everything is just perfect.
Including the law. I mean, the law is talked about, so it's like very ideal. It's almost romantic. I mean, there's, you know, there's like a love for the words, the law, the precepts, the statutes that, I don't know, I mean, in some ways could fit right into like a Song of Songs type vibe. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I could see that.
It's just, it's like we are describing it with this beautiful adjective and then we're extolling it for this wonderful thing that it does.
Yeah. The effervescence that you might expect from a lover.
Yes.
You know, going on about their beloved.
Yes, yes, like that, which I think we're going to get to that also a little bit later.
Okay.
But for now, I that's what I see. What do you see?
Yeah, I think it's orientation. I don't think it could be anything else. There's barely even a hint of disorientation. Like there's no, it's like a vague idea off in the distance, like, oh, yeah, you know what? I might be making some kind of an error, but I mean, I don't even know.
Yeah.
Like that's all hidden.
Right.
And like, don't let me get into anything else over there. But I want to be innocent.
Which is really different from, so last week we talked about Psalm 32, and there in that Psalm, sin is a very disorienting kind of force in the life of the psalmist. And a lot of the Psalm is just kind of dealing with that. And here there is like a mention of it, but it's very, you're just passing over it almost at the end, and it doesn't at all carry the same kind of weight.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, Brent, when you said you love this Psalm, that you think about it all the time, say more about that. When is this Psalm crossing your mind? Why are you always thinking about it?
Most of the time when I think about it is when I'm flying. And
which you do a lot?
I mean, there, not nearly as often as I would like to. I did work for an airline for a couple of years, so I flew quite a bit more back then. I wasn't a flight attendant, so I wasn't flying multiple times a day, but I took a fair number of trips. And the experience of being on an airplane at sunrise is just incredible. Even on like a rainy, cloudy day where you're just in this dark, thick rain, and then you go up above the clouds and it's like, wow, this is the brightest day I've ever seen. That transformational experience. But the thing about it is I actually mostly focus on just the first few verses. I don't even get to the part
where
God pitched the tent for the sun. Like it feels, and I don't know if that's just in English. I don't think we know enough Hebrew necessarily at this point to understand how well that flows. But in English anyway, it feels like it's kind of a weird break even in that first part, where it's just this like abstract, all-encompassing glory. And then all of a sudden it just like zooms in on the sun. So even that is like, and like the image of a bridegroom and a champion, I'm like, whatever. I don't need that part. So mostly I'm focusing on just that first part of the psalm. But yeah, I think about it all the time, every time I fly. it's just always there for me.
I want to read those verses real quick one more time to refresh. So these first four verses that say, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands, which is, as you're saying that to me, I'm imagining going above the clouds in an airplane, and how, like what you said about how transformational it is, it's almost like there's a whole other world of skies above the skies that we mostly see from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them, yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world.
Yeah, and when you're up high like that, you can see, you feel like you can see to the end of the world. I mean, it's not quite going to space, but it's way,
right,
way more than we get on the ground. And even night flights, like being able to see the cities in the distance and sometimes a lightning storm over the darkness or whatever, like there's just all sorts of things that you get to see up there that you don't see in the same way from the ground or even at all.
There's this story that from, I was probably 22 or 3. I was a student at Truman and I was out at my campus minister's house. They lived way out in the country. The BAMA team was actually there recently. There's this tradition that people have of going to what's called the train bridge. It's, you know, when you don't have a lot of entertainment in Kirksville, you make your own entertainment and you go stand on this bridge that's just barely high enough to go over the top of a train as it zooms underneath you, and you stand there and it's sort of like a roller coaster ride, except for you are staying still and the ride is moving underneath you.
Yeah, I don't know what I did go out there and I did get to experience a train going under the bridge, and I don't know what the clearance is in actuality, but it's got to be measured in inches.
It feels very, very small, the clearance. So anyway, we were out there one summer evening, and when you stand on this bridge and you look north, you can see way down the train tracks, the corridor that's made for the train tracks. And it was this incredible convergence of different lights and atmospheric conditions where overhead, you could see the stars starting to come out. It was twilight. And when you looked down the track, at the horizon point, there was a big thunderhead that was brewing, where it wasn't a storm all over, you know, the skies everywhere you looked, but just localized down in this one spot. There was this big thunderhead, and the remains of the evening sunlight were hitting it, and it was turning like a little bit, you know, just kind of orange and red. And you could also see lightning flashing within it. And then you look below, down at the field level, just off to the side of the tracks, and you see like a million lightning bugs. Do you guys have lightning bugs in Idaho, by the way?
I don't believe so. I don't think I've seen any.
Man.
But I did get to experience them in Kansas. But yeah, that is, I mean, there's so much about Kansas that I miss, especially this time of year. I miss the big thunderstorms. We had a little bit of a storm last night as we're recording, and it was like most of the lightning's up in the cloud. I did get to see a couple of bolts out in the open, which was nice, but that's, you know, somewhat rare. We definitely don't get tornadoes. We, like, the idea of what you're describing, like, I can picture it so clearly because I've seen things like that, but like imagining something like that up in Idaho where I am, not going
to
happen.
Shout out to all my Midwestern people who are listening. And I really do feel for you, people who live in regions of the country or the world where you don't have lightning bugs, because they are just a tiny, almost minuscule, but magnificent phenomenon, especially when you have thousands of them all lighting up intermittently. So just imagine you're looking at a field of grass at dusk, and you don't even know, you wouldn't know that they were bugs unless somebody told you. It would just be this weird phenomenon where randomly you're having neon green lights, that just little pinpricks of light that like boop, 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 all over the place. So this is what's going on. Stars overhead, lightning in a thundercloud down at the horizon, and then below our feet, all of these lightning bugs. And it was I mean, it was obviously really beautiful, and there was a sort of stillness. And then my campus minister and I were standing there, and he quotes this psalm, these first few verses, about the, you know, the sky proclaiming the glory of God, and how they're using, they have no speech, but their voice goes out. And he says these few lines, and then he just looks at me, and he says, "Are you listening?" And then it just hung there like that. And I thought, I don't know. Am I listening? And there was this like resounding sort of, it was like a voice that didn't have, you know, words, and yet somehow was like penetrating down deeply. Like I was hearing something as after he said that, because of, you know, the skies and the different lights. And it was, I don't know, it was just, I've always remembered that story ever since. Are you listening? Are you listening? Yeah, that's it.
And I love that story so much that I titled this episode after it.
Mm-hmm.
So the weird thing about this psalm is because I've always focused on the beginning part, I was like, what am I missing? How am I not like finding anywhere close to as much meaning in the rest of it?
Hmm.
So I was trying to figure out what some of the other perspectives were on this psalm, and I found a few quotes, a few ideas.
When you say, when you say it wasn't connecting with you, the later part, are you talking about the part specifically where it starts talking about the statutes and the precepts and all of that?
Yeah, especially that part.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel that too.
So C.S. Lewis said, "I take this to be the greatest poem in the Psalter and one of the greatest lyrics in the world."
Oh.
Which I was very surprised. I'm like, I love this psalm, but I don't even know if I would say that necessarily.
Yeah, so I don't think I would say that.
Strong words, either way. But okay, sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's very good. I mean, there are a few other psalms that I gravitate towards personally. Like I love Psalm 139 and always will. That'll probably always be my favorite one. Though it's not necessarily my life psalm, everyone.
Ooh, okay.
I
don't think Psalm 19 is my life psalm, but if I was picking, I think I might pick it because I do love it so much.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So C.S. Lewis did not turn out to be particularly helpful for me in this quest. But I found another one, Charles Spurgeon, saying that this psalm compares and contrasts the study of God's two great books, nature and scripture. I'm like, okay, I feel like that's starting to get at something. And then a bunch of Jewish commentators have made similar connections. Rashi says the Torah enlightens man just as the sun lights his way. It's like, okay, I can see how those would work together. Ibn Ezra and Radak said something along the lines of both the sun and the Torah testify to the glory of their creator. It's like, okay, sure. That sounds reasonable. It doesn't have that same, doesn't have the feeling necessarily. It doesn't give me the feeling in the second part as I get in the first part, but I'm like, okay, I see how these maybe go together.
Mm-hmm.
Metzudat David said the Torah is more perfect, whole or complete than the powerful sun. So it's like, okay, you've got all this glory, and it's like, okay.
Those are strong words.
Yeah, that starts to like cut a little bit into me where I'm like, okay, I'm focusing on all this stuff, and it's like, oh yeah, but the Torah is more perfect, whole and complete than what you're focusing on. It's like, okay, all right, a little convicting. And then I don't know how you say any of these names really. While the sun conveys God's glory and greatness in the physical world, the Torah expresses God's glory in the spiritual realm. It still feels a little disconnected to me, but I've always thought that I should appreciate the rest of it more.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes on a flight, like I'll mm-hmm. be all excited about those first few verses. I'll read through it, and then I'm like, I should really work on the rest of this psalm because I feel like I should know the rest of it because the first few verses I have memorized. But I just never had a framework to like connect it and make it click. It's never actually stuck. It just kind of feels like that second part, it just feels like another Psalm 119 in sort of an abbreviated form. So many words to say the same thing over and over and over again. It's beautiful. And especially the way you read it, I think emphasizes the beauty of like all of the different aspects of what God's word is, but it still kind of feels pointless.
Yeah, yeah. I want to jump in actually here with some thoughts about the law. I think this is a good spot for it because I also felt this way a lot growing up. I remember reading and hearing Psalm 119 especially and thinking, man, I just don't get it. I do not feel this. And part of that could be because I was a kid, I was a teenager, you know, reading sure. the Bible in some ways was kind of boring, especially those certain sections that we all know about where it's like, maybe I'll just kind of skip over these. And along with that, there was this teaching, this training about the Hebrew scriptures and about the law that I had been given that really didn't help me at all when it came to this, and actually felt like I was kind of, I don't know, just of two minds about, like, when I read Psalm 119, because here is this thing, or Psalm 19, like we already said, extolling the beauties of the law, but then I was being told that the law was just sort of a bunch of rules about how to get to heaven. And that beyond that, it's kind of like this rigged game where what I was told about the law is that primarily it's there to make you understand that you have no hope apart from God. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, do you know this strand of thinking that where
exactly
it's like, yeah, you know, if you could keep the law, then you get saved. This is what Jews believe, is what I was told.
That's what I have believed at various times as well.
Right. But really, what you should get from reading the law is that you're incompetent and you're wretched and you're incapable. And then I would read Psalm 19 or Psalm 119 and I would say, huh? How do these people think this thing is so... I mean, they're not talking about it in those terms, like, well, this is necessary for our good. I mean, they're, like we already said, they're in love with the thing, right?
Yeah.
And it just didn't make any sense to me. And then I started to have a different understanding about what the law is and how it should be seen and what it should be seen for. And I had this picture come to mind. There are those bad ideas about Torah that say, if you imagine a path, picture a path, and Torah is a path that you walk, and at the end of that path is heaven or salvation or whatever you want to call it. And if you can finish hiking that path without any missteps, then you win, you get there. But I think a better idea about Torah says that walking the path that is Torah doesn't so much lead to life as it is life. Much like if you imagine hiking, like one of the most beautiful places that I've been is Yosemite Valley in California. And if you hike, you know, a 10-mile loop above Yosemite Valley, you might come right back to the same place you started, right? You might leave from the parking lot and come back to the parking lot. And yet you are much more alive than ever just by the act of walking that path. And so to keep Torah, to walk the path, is kind of like life itself. And to break it, to step off it, isn't just like an arbitrary, oh, you broke the rules, but like, oh, you're actually stepping off a cliff, you know? I'm going to talk about Buechner for a second, and I'm not going to apologize, L.
Why would you apologize?
I never would, not for talking about Buechner. And he talks about how there are basically two kinds of laws. There are laws about the way that things should be, and there are laws about the way that things are. And so he says, an example of the first one, the way things should be, is no trespassing. You shouldn't go over here. Don't be over here. And an example of the second, he says, is the law of gravity. It's just the way that things are. And a lot of us typically think of law, when it comes to God's law, as the first kind. Things that you should and shouldn't do, a way that things ought to be. But he says, actually, it's the law in itself is category number two. It's the one that is the way that things are. And then he says, Buechner says, it's been stated in seven words, and he quotes 1 John, whoever does not love abides in death. And he says, like it or not, this is how it is. And then he says, if you don't believe it, you can put it to the test the same way that if you don't believe the law of gravity, you can always step out a 10th story window and find out what happens. And so if love is the fulfilling of the law, then to walk the path, to walk Torah, is really just a matter of walking in love, as I think Jesus would say, as I think Paul would say. And beyond that, or underneath that way of thinking about to walk the path is to truly love, there is this undergirding kind of burning fire that I know Marty has talked about at various times on the podcast, but that it is this sense that I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine, and the law is a gift from my beloved, this is God, to me, and that my keeping it is like a gift that I am giving back to my beloved. And so how could I ever see that as just like toilsome and burdensome? And of course, the point isn't to tell me that I'm incompetent. It is to give me a way to walk. And then I start to see, okay, this is how Psalm 119, this is how these sentiments are kind of possible, that we can truly, really adore this thing, that we can love the living of it, because not arbitrarily, because we're supposed to, but because the living of it is actually good.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Is that from a book or a sermon or something that I can link to?
What's that? About the path?
Yeah, the Buechner thing.
Oh, the Buechner thing. Yeah, the Buechner thing is from his book, Wishful Thinking. Wishful Thinking is a little dictionary. I've talked about it before. And this is from his definition of law.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm happy to hear that you had a good moment of discovery that helped you appreciate this.
You still looking for yours?
Well, no, I think I found it, actually. Oh. So enter Rabbi David Foreman into the chat. I found, as I was looking around, and I didn't expect to, I don't think I was actually looking for this. I found this a couple of months ago before we even planned on doing this episode. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, oh, Foreman's got something on Psalm 19. Cool. I would probably enjoy that. I like Psalm 19. So he has this, so it's a membership required thing. It's just like it seems like Foreman made some sort of discovery and he's like, Emu, I need to call you and tell you what I just found. And Emu's driving, but has the sense to record it. And so we're just listening to this conversation.
Oh, for real?
Yeah. Like it's the most casual thing.
I love that. I love how behind the curtain that is. Inspiration struck and you're driving, but I need you to take this down quick.
Yeah. So, and he didn't even necessarily, so this is like what I'm going to share is probably about a quarter of the things that he talks about. So it's a fairly condensed thing. So I would still recommend checking it out. I'll link to it, of course. But Emu starts off by mentioning that this is a chapter of Tehillim, which I guess is the Psalms, Hebrew mm-hmm. word for Psalms, mm-hmm. that they recite as part of the Sabbath morning prayers. And it also seems to be used in many, if not maybe even all of the Jewish holidays. It's very difficult to find a succinct list of all the things that they do. But particularly it's used in Shavuot. But I was like, oh, well, of course, like Sabbath is God's glory. Like this backwards, upside down glory of God is found in rest rather than achievement. So yeah, like, of course, I do think creation is this way to glimpse God's glory. But then in Psalm 19, we actually see creation pointing somewhere else. So it's not the truest representation of the glory. It's like, okay, I'm getting off track here a little bit. But Foreman starts to get into this by pointing out the sheer wonder of the first three sentences, which felt very validating to me.
Oh, yeah.
The sky, the heavens, they're telling the works of God. It's like, okay, yeah. Yeah. Like, I definitely feel that wonder, of course.
Yeah. I think wonder is a word to describe what I was lost for words on earlier about my story at the train bridge. I think this sense of wonder is what I was experiencing when my campus minister said, are you listening?
Yeah. It's actually a word I've been thinking about a lot the last few weeks, which is interesting. I don't know that I necessarily have anything specific to share on that, but it's just, it seems to be coming up a lot for me recently. But then you have this twist, of course, in verse 3, which, as by the way, as you hear them talking about it, the verses are numbered differently in the Hebrew text. So what we think of as verse 3, Foreman will refer to as verse 4. And I'll get to that more in a second. But in verse 3, you see that all this talking is actually without words. The heavens are speaking, but silently. Totally my experience in flying. There's nothing that I'm hearing other than the, you know, the low whir of the airplane and the, you know, obnoxious interruptions of the flight attendants making all their announcements about how proud they are of all the frequent flyers and whatever. But like, sure, I'm on the airplane. Intellectually, I think I should feel like an idiot for taking so many pictures whenever I'm on a plane.
No.
But I can't actually bring myself to stop doing it. Like every time I'm like, do I really need another 30 pictures of random clouds? And I'm like, no, but then I do it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like this wonder of the heavens never ceases.
Have you ever, who was the comedian? Oh, wait, it's from Louis C.K.
I'm pretty sure I've seen that.
But the thing about flying in an airplane and how people complain about like, oh, the Wi-Fi isn't working. This sucks. And he's like, oh, really? Are you partaking in the miracle of flight like a bird? Yeah. And he's like, you know, people, we fly across the country in 3 hours. That used to take, you know, your family 8 months, and there'd be different people when you got there than when you started because people died and people were being born.
Yeah, I've heard
anyway,
that before.
Yeah, so no, we should, yeah, just validating, like, of course, it's weird that it becomes normal to us that we're like, oh, I'm above the, like, I think we experience looking at the clouds out the window as if we're watching a TV show and we don't realize that we're really located in space up there. Like your physical body is like, just imagine that the airplane were to disappear and suddenly you're just up there in the clouds. That's crazy, man.
And I'm sure I've shared this somewhere before. I don't know. But like, I love flying so much that if you gave me the choice of being able to go on a vacation, like pick your exotic destination, I don't care, any destination, and you could just go there and just snap your finger and you're in the place, or you could fly there, not even get off the plane and fly back. And that would be a difficult decision for me because I love flying
really?
So much. Yeah. Like when I, like I'll get an upgrade and I get upgraded into an aisle seat out of my window seat and I'm disappointed. Like I have, you know, an extra 3 or 4 inches of leg room and I get extra snacks or whatever, but I don't have my window seat. It's like, oh man.
Okay. I'm starting to understand more about you, Brent, because I also know that you just have a love for the logistics and the mechanical aspects of air traffic and flying in airports, that you like to track just air, even from the ground on your phone, you're tracking flights that your loved ones aren't even on. You're just tracking flights because that's what you like to do. The way that some people like to go to the train station and just watch the different models of trains go by.
Yeah. Also the ones that my loved ones are on, of course.
But yeah. Well, that's the normal thing. We don't need to point that out. It's that you're watching air traffic for just random flights. But this makes sense. This is clicking for me now. And I think it's wonderful, this love, never ending, you know, kind of wonder at being up in the sky. Yeah, I think it's good that you're not so, I don't know, numb or hard-hearted that you've lost all sense of like curiosity and wonder about the thing.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
So Foreman pointed out, when you think about movement in the world, movement is usually accompanied by sound. I think airplanes are a great example of this. Like those engines are loud if you are underneath. So you would assume that when the sun moves and the stars move and all of these like incomprehensibly huge celestial objects are moving, it would be accompanied by this earth-shattering sound. But then it is actually utterly silent. And this is like verse 4, yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. And that voice word is actually apparently controversial. The Hebrew text, the Masoretic text, says measuring line.
That's really different from voice.
Yeah. And the voice word comes from the Septuagint and Jerome and the Syriac.
Okay.
Foreman says that some commentaries understand voice as a word for expression, but Ibn Ezra, who we mentioned before, actually, understood it the way Foreman understands it as line. It's like, okay. But then you have their words in the next, you know, in the second half of that, what do you call it, a doublet?
Yeah.
That verse is a doublet, the second half.
Is it a couplet?
Oh, couplet. I don't know.
Yeah, I think a doublet is something you wear, and I think a couplet is like a pair of lines in a stanza.
Okay. So either way, the second half, like it says, their words. So like you do have that idea of speech. And I like just trying to understand like why in the world would this be like this? Like L scoffs at the idea of using the Septuagint.
Mm-hmm.
Taking precedence over the Hebrew text, but I also kind of get it because the Septuagint, you know, dates from a couple hundred years BC and the Masoretic text is at the earliest 7th century AD.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's like corroborating stuff between the Dead Sea Scroll. Like it's very complicated trying to understand it.
So we're trying to get to the bottom of, is this voice or line?
Yeah. Is it their voice goes out in the Elderworth or their measuring line or their line?
And so you're saying that let me just try to keep it straight in my brain. The line is from the Septuagint?
Line is from the Hebrew, from the Masoretic text.
Okay, so the Masoretic text is line and the Septuagint is voice.
Yeah, and a couple of other sources also corroborate the voice idea.
Okay.
Which, you know, like it does, I don't know. It's just, I try to investigate this stuff, and this is one of those things where the NET commentators, like, I'm sure they have their reasons. But it just sounds so maddeningly arbitrary when I read this. Listen to this NET footnote.
Okay.
The Masoretic text reads, their measuring line, in Hebrew, kum. The noun, kav, measuring line, makes no sense in this context. The reading, kolam, their voice, supported by the Septuagint, is preferable. That's the entire footnote. Why is it preferable?
Kolam is one letter removed, a kol, right? Kol is voice in Hebrew. Kolam, their voice. So I guess it's, I'm trying to figure out just linguistically with my very, I'm trying to make Elle proud because she's been teaching Hebrew. And they are similar-ish words. I mean, kav.
Yeah, the difference is a missing lamed in the middle of the word.
Okay, yeah, that is...
Which, I mean, sure, like, I could see how they would be making copies and just, you know, they'd miss that letter somehow. Like, that happens, and there's also... It's kind of crazy, as we've been learning Hebrew, like, all the times where it's like, oh, there's actually... This letter's there, but it's just not like
it's
you don't
dropped
see
off.
It.
They drop
the letter, and you know that it's dropped because they put this dot over here. It's like, okay. So it's like it's a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. And the NET footnotes are already ridiculously extensive, so I guess I can't expect them to have an explanation for every single thing they do. But it's just in those times where it's like, oh, I really want to know what is going on here, and they're like, well, it just doesn't make sense. This other thing's preferable. It's like, what?
Man, yeah, just a look behind the curtain of Bible translation choices. It's, it could be either. We'll go with this one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so back to Psalm 19.
Yeah.
We've been talking about the heavens up to this point, but then we get specifically to the sun, which Foreman is pointing out, runs a circuit of the sky in a line. And it's like, you know, it's a curved line, but it's like the sun has a line that it goes through. So maybe the measuring line does actually work.
But the,
in addition to the voice,
yes, their voice, their line, that is from the heavens, the skies though. The sun hasn't even come in at this point.
Well, yeah, but then it is about to come in. So it's like, hey, there's this line and then you're about to see the sun like come out
okay,
of his tent.
Yeah. And it does, I mean, it talks about it running a course.
Yeah, right.
Like a prescribed, you know, path or a line, I guess you could say.
So there's actually a lot of like imagery here that I have not appreciated before. So like Foreman is talking about how, you know, this psalm has two parts to it. And the first part being about the heavens, and particularly the sun declaring itself as a product of God's handiwork. So like, I've never really stopped and tried to imagine this scene, but here's the verse. In the heavens, God has pitched a tent for the sun. I was actually talking to Darius about this last night as he was going to bed. I was like, what, like, is there actually a tent in the sky? He's like, no. I was like, what would that look like? We're trying to imagine this together. It's like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, which also is kind of a weird like in a modern wedding context, which I'm around a lot because I do wedding photography. Like this is not a glorious moment. It's like, okay, man, it's time to do the first look. Better get you out in position. Like, and then we're waiting on the bride. And
does he come out of the bride? Or does the bridegroom come out of his tent before or after? Is this like a, you know, he's going ready. He's going to immediately kind of wed his bride. Or is this like they've gone into their marital chamber and he's coming out after that, you know, and like, it's like,
yeah, I don't know.
They've just they've consummated and he's coming out. But whichever there is like the bridegroom and the champion, I get a very sort of, what's coming to my mind is Gaston, like not in the, you know, from Beauty and the Beast, not in like the arrogance of Gaston, but the sort of like, the big, you know, the chest is out, the I can do anything, the sort of bravado, the, you know what I'm saying? Like that,
yeah,
just like chomping at the bit, the confidence, and you have this son is just ready to burst out and do the course, run the line that God has set for it to do with a sort of exuberance, you know, it's not just a mechanical mm-hmm. sort of clockwork thing that's happening.
Yeah. And I didn't actually look into this, but I was just pondering the question, has God pitched a tent in the heavens for anyone or anything else?
Mm.
And so I don't know, exercise for the listener to do some research. But then we have the other part of this psalm, which is about Torah or God's word or God's commands or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, even Foreman's like, well, it's not immediately clear what the connection is between them, which is exactly how I've always felt.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, yes, great, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, like I said before, the specificity of the sun just felt so strange. I wanted to think of the clouds. I wanted to think of like the light generally, whatever else. So this is where Foreman says, okay, so there's two parts with seven verses each. So the intro statement, like the Psalm of David part, like that's verse one in the Hebrew text.
Okay.
And so then what we have is 1-6 is the rest of that. And then 7-13 will be the second part. And then the last verse stands alone. And we'll talk about that at the end. So of the two sevens though, it's like, it's very jarring how these two sides work together. There's all this talk about the heavens and the sun, and then it's a very abrupt transition to talking about God's words. And it doesn't seem like the one has anything to do with the other. But then if you actually look at all of the pieces of the Torah portion, the part of the psalm that talks about Torah is saturated with this sun-like language. So you have the law of the Lord is perfect, or complete, or whole, or pure, depending on how you want to look at that, refreshing the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. So how do we assess the purity of something? And generally, you need like a bright light to do that.
Hmm.
Like people will say,
okay, yeah, I see what you're saying.
You should use dark fabrics if you want to hide stains. But if you've got enough light on that thing, it will reveal the purity of that garment.
Yeah, for sure.
And then like sunlight refreshing the soul, like, yeah, like, doesn't it feel so good to step out into a warm sun? And even on like the hottest days, it can still feel good for a moment. It refreshes the plants and animals. Like you have these cycles of temperature, like it's coldest right before the sun comes out. And then the sun brings that warmth back, like evaporation happens. El talks about this actually a lot, not in like any biblical context, but just like, oh, for the maintenance of proper sleep cycles and waking energy levels and your attentiveness, like you need to get sunlight in your eyes as early in the day as possible. Like, yeah, like that is what the sun is doing. And then we have the trustworthiness aspect, and like, how can you really trust something that you haven't seen in the light? You think you put on two black socks when you got dressed in your dark bedroom, but then what happens when you step out into the sunlight, Reed?
You got navy or navy and black.
Yeah, yeah.
Or like dark brown and black.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like there is a strong connecting tie that has to do with light. The light that the sun gives is like the light that Torah gives.
Yeah, and all like it's It's like other psalms point this out so clearly. And I yeah, your word is a lamp to my feet. Like, how many of us have sung that song or at least know that phrase, but just like, I've never looked at this in this way.
Well, I want to say too, think about you start with the heavens at the beginning and then it moves to the sun. So we're going from something broader with a million stars in it to this one star, this one light. And that is, I mean, just imagine the different sense you would get if Torah were compared to the skies full of stars, you know, like a starry night, if it were compared to a starry night versus the star that is the sun, because they're both stars. But the psalmist wants to draw the connection between Torah and specifically the brightest light in the sky by a million miles. Like, there are other kinds of lights, right? There's the light of the moon, which we know, of course, is actually just the light of the sun being reflected. There is the light of the stars. There are even, you know, think about the story that I told. Other things in the atmosphere can give light, lightning. But none of those will do when it comes to what the Torah is like. That is the sun. It is the thing that shines light on everything else. This is reminding, there's a C.S. Lewis quote that is, how does it go? I believe in, he either says God or Jesus or the gospel, in the same way that I believe in the sun. Not only is it the only light I see in the sky, but also by its light, I see everything else. Have you heard this quote?
I don't think so.
That's Lewis. I know for sure it's Lewis, and I've got it pretty close, if not, I don't think it's exact, but it's pretty close. But I think that's how we would say the psalmist here feels about Torah. They would say, I believe in Torah the way that I believe in the sun. Not only is it the brightest light that I see, but it is also the light by which I see everything else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which again, doesn't really work if you've spent your whole life being told that this is just here to tell you like how hopeless everything is and to make you want to wait around for Jesus.
Yeah, right. Well, and that's the next part. Like, the precepts of the Lord are right or straight, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. And this kind of comes back to the line idea. Emu pointed out, in as much as we're talking about the line of the sky and the circuit of the sun being sure or reliable. And then we have this point here that the words of God are also straight. They're also right. A lot of geometry stuff going on that I'm not like, not my favorite kind of math at all.
Yeah, but think about orientation, right? The way that we orient ourselves in the world is off at its most basic when we don't have GPS and we don't have a map. We do it by the sun and by the stars. Those are because we know that there is that constant line that they are traveling.
Yes.
So that if I need to know which direction I'm facing, well, where is the sun and which way is the sun moving? And now I know.
Yeah. And speaking of the orientation and disorientation thing, Marty actually used this prayer by Thomas Merton for a time of reflection on one of our recent ICM staff calls. Totally different from what we're seeing here. This contrast like struck me. It starts out, "My Lord God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end." And then later it says, "I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the straight road, by the right road, though I may know nothing about it, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death." Total prayer of disorientation by Merton. Not at all what we're seeing in Psalm 19. God's words give joy to our hearts. His commands are radiant, and you know, maybe some more obvious sun imagery in that part of it specifically.
Sure.
Give light to our eyes. We've never been more sure about where we're going and what lies ahead in Psalm 19.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nature of the orientation psalms, the spirit of them. I mean, and we should be careful not to throw out the Merton types of prayers or the other psalms of disorientation, as we've now talked about several by this point in this series. But there is a time where this is the spirit of the thing that we need to be praying, that we need to be hoping in, that we need to be walking by, is that there is this assuredness. There is this sureness that, yes, in fact, here is this, I guess I'll just the words that the psalmist is already using. Here is this thing, this law that does give us light, that does set a path that is trustworthy, that does make wise. It is trustworthy and dependable and all of that. Not to devolve into, because of all of these various things we want to make up about, well, I shouldn't say make up so casually, but all of these attributes we want to accrete onto it about inerrancy or whatever, the psalmist is not going on to say all of that. But I think because, I don't know, this weird poetic way that it compares Torah to the creation, both of them being given from God, both of them also being dependent upon God. There is a walk with God that has to happen.
Yeah. So then we have the fear of the Lord is pure or clean, enduring forever. The decrees of the Lord are firm and all of them are righteous. And this is something that I think we actually understand a lot better than David did, but sunlight cleanses and purifies things. The idea of enduring forever and being firm certainly seem to apply to the sun, in spite of our modern astronomical understanding of what may eventually happen to the sun long after we're gone.
Right, of course.
Foreman said that he thinks the sun is the closest representation we have of eternality, of like of permanence. Like, does that ring true to you? Like, the most permanent thing in our world is the sun and its,
well,
you know, relentless rising and falling and bringing warmth and whatever.
Well, I have a few thoughts about that. One is that the sun is integrally a part of our world and yet is also apart from it completely.
Yeah.
It's not a part of the world the same way that a mountain is a part of the world. Another thing I think is, it's not just, I'm curious about this word eternality, which is different to me than just talking of permanence. But when I think about eternality, I think about, you know, sort of past and present and future all kind of being brought together into one. That to me is eternity.
Yeah.
It's not just endless time that goes on forever, but it's kind of the essence of time. And I know this is really esoteric sounding, so I'm not going to go too far with it, but just past and present and future sort of all being kind of squashed into like an experience or a moment or like a quality. And so does the sun feel like that to me, as in past, present, and future?
And I don't know exactly what Foreman was getting. It was a very much a passing comment, but like the stars have actually shifted in our view of the night sky since the time that this was written, but not the sun. The sun's been doing the same thing for us as it has been for them.
Well, yeah, because we relate to the sun, our planet relates to the sun differently than we relate to other stars, because the sun is our star. It is the thing that is constraining our orbit. And so as it moves, we move with it. And I think the sun is, in fact, moving through space. It's moving around the Milky Way galaxy.
Right.
But as it moves, it takes everything with it that is in its orbit, you know? And so we don't actually perceive that it is moving, even though it is, because we're moving alongside of it. Now we're getting into, like, I don't know, relativity and stuff.
Well, yeah, and it's difficult to know what of this they might have understood. Like, I don't think they saw the sun as this, you know, permanently placed object in the sky the way we do. Like, there's lots of questions.
No. But it is actually interesting. I sometimes wonder about things like this, where now in modern science we understand the movement of space and just the nature of space differently than the writers of the scripture did. But if, as a modern day, like if I were an astrophysicist, knowing what I know about the sun, what kind of a psalm would I write now that would compare, you know, Torah to it? Or, you know, for Christians, maybe we're comparing the gospel to the sun, or something along those lines. Now that we understand things about quantum physics or astrophysics. So I guess I would just invite our scientifically minded listeners to engage in that and let us know what you come up with. So if we know that the sun is not actually fixed, but is moving through space and we're moving along with it, for example, how would you use that to illuminate our understanding or our relationship to the scripture, to the text, to the gospel?
Yeah. And it's almost surprising how well some of these modern ideas fit into the words of the psalm. Like just that idea of sunlight cleansing things. Like, did they really have any kind of understanding of that? But at the same time, they did understand that in some like deeper sense. I don't know. Okay, so moving on in the psalm. They are more precious than gold, than much pure gold. They are sweeter than honey from the honeycomb. By them your servant is warned. In keeping them there is great reward. So what does the sun look like, Reed?
Well, if I look at every picture I ever drew as a kid, it looks like a yellow circle with some little triangles, like, you know, going around the circumference of it, pointing outward.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
and
then
what,
I've seen...
What color did you use to draw that picture?
Yellow, of course.
Which is the color of...
Gold.
For example, gold and...
Honey.
Honey.
Yeah.
And then Forman says that idea actually even continues into the next verse, potentially, because the word nitzar... Even though it means warning, if you remove the prefix noon, you get zohar, which means sunlight.
Oh.
So maybe the psalmist is doing a play on words in this, by them your servant is warned or warmed, even, you know, thinking a little more abstract than that. Hmm. But who can discern their errors, forgive or cleanse my hidden faults? And nikani, cleanse. Is a form of naka, which is a synonym for purity, as we talked about before.
Okay.
So lots of lots of wordplay going on in this part of the psalm. Keep your servant also from willful sins. May they not rule over me. Then I will be blameless, innocent of great transgression. Mm-hmm. And so what do you do, Reed, if you're willfully sinning?
If I'm willfully sinning?
Yeah, like if you know you're doing something wrong.
Yeah, and I'm doing it anyway. It. Yeah. I mean, I definitely don't let anybody know about it.
Yeah, you hide it.
I hide it, yeah.
And how do you hide things? You keep them in the dark.
Yeah, of course.
So Forman points out, like, there's this brief peek into the darkness before coming back to this blameless and innocent state. You know, as we talked about before, like this idea, this disorientation idea is very much off in the distance. We're not there at all. Mm-hmm. But the psalmist seems pretty determined to argue that Torah is very similar to sunlight. Okay. So how is that so? He asks. If you come back to the first half of the psalm, the heavens are thunderously proclaiming God, and yet it's all silence. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. They have nothing to say. But then what is the Torah full of? The Torah is full of words.
Yeah.
The sun has a lot to say, but it doesn't have anything to say in this cognitive realm. So Torah is this expression of God's will, and it's all cognitive. It doesn't do what the sun does. It doesn't actually shine. It doesn't light things up in a physical sense. So the psalmist is taking these seemingly inverse aspects and suggesting that each, in fact, has what the other has. He's describing it, the sun, as if it had the Torah's qualities, as if it were cognitive, as if it had something to say, and therefore the heavens declare the glory of God. So the heavens are declaring cognitively this thing about God, even as no sound is heard from them. So then we get to Torah, and Torah is clearly made out of words, but then that's not really the point. The point is that the sunlight qualities of shining, the texture and the color of the gold and the honey, the psalmist is borrowing from each side to bring the other this like liveliness. The straightness of the sun is a metaphor for Torah.
The straightness of like the course of the sun is what you mean.
Yeah, right. The like and the reliability of the sun. Like it's right, it's true, it's every day. And then And then Emu commented at this point, like, it's almost like the rising of the sun and the lighting up of the sky is what provokes us to the need to pray the Shacharit, the morning prayers, which can include the reading of Torah, among, like, it's not just these separate prayers, like reading Torahs is sometimes part of that. So the sun rises and reminds us of who we are and why we're here. And then the Torah gives us the actual words that illuminate our purpose.
Yeah.
The sun brings life to the world. God's words bring life to humanity.
Yeah. That makes me think of, if I imagine the Torah coming out in the morning, you know, to like run its course across a day in the life, right? Like if the text is going, so another thing, this is related to where my brain is going at the moment. Where does it say, we're talking about sin, the brief, you know, excursion into darkness. And he says, keep your servant from willful sins. May they not rule over me. And I haven't looked at all at the Hebrew here, but when I hear, may they not rule over me, I go back to the creation story and how the sun was given as a light to rule over the day.
Mm.
And now I think of the role of, so if sin is not going to rule over me, then what ought to rule over me?
Yes.
And of course the answer is, well, God ought to rule over me. But what does that look like for the psalmist? I think it looks like the text. It looks like the precepts, the law. Let those things rule over me instead. And so then I imagine if in the beginning of my day, just as the sun is rising and bursting out of its tent to like run its course and rule over, you know, the world, the creation of the world, so also the text kind of bursts out, if I will let it, and it can rule over a day in my own life, you know, directing as I meditate on it, as I internalize it, as I try to walk the path, you know, that it goes on a path. I am walking the path that it is, so that it might rule over me, and so that, you know, we might be able to live lives that are faithful to God and not to, you know, whatever our own sort of either willful or hidden kinds of sinful desires would be.
Okay. So the final portion of this psalm is like this, it's outside of the 7 and 7 verses. Remember, the verse numbers are different in the Hebrew text.
Yes.
So what we call verse 14, actually verse 15, falls outside of the 7 and 7. And it's like this closing prayer of sorts. May these words of my mouth and this meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Reed, when you hear that, rock and redeemer, how do those things relate to each other?
You know, I looked at this question last night when you sent the notes over to me, and I was laying in bed thinking about this.
Perfect.
And I don't actually think that I have a great answer for a rock and a redeemer, because I think of a rock as, I think of a big rock when I hear rock, not just like one you take and skip in the water, like a mountain, you know, a boulder.
Yeah, even a mountain. I think I typically think boulder, but yes, mountain, I think, is just as applicable.
And so I think of a great big heavy stationary thing that is also beautiful. But when I thought about Redeemer, the first thing that came to my mind, and then I couldn't stop thinking about it, was Harriet Tubman. In our common prayer book that we use every evening at dinner, it was, I don't know, a week ago or 2 weeks ago, there was a blurb in the sort of devotional section of the prayer for that evening about Harriet Tubman and the work that she did. A lot of it was in secret, to free or redeem. That's what I think of when I think of redeeming these slaves, of getting them to freedom out of a life of slavery, and how she was constantly moving back and forth, you know, underground across state lines and across international borders to Canada to get these slaves to freedom. And I guess the only thing I came up with, like, what does a rock have in common with Harriet Tubman, was that for the people that she is rescuing, that she is probably a firm foundation. She is the thing that they are leaning on to get them. So it's like a rock, but it's a rock that's moving, I guess. I don't know. That's not a very great answer, but that's all I could think about last night laying in bed.
Well, I mean, that's pretty close to what Torah. That's pretty close to what Foreman is talking about. Mm. these two things, like one moves and the other doesn't move. And the strength of the Redeemer is in its movement, and the strength of the rock is in its non-movement, its stationariness, its ability to just be there. So when you look at the psalm, does the Son express God as a Redeemer, or does the Son express God as a rock? Because the Son is moving. But if you think about Torah, does Torah express God as Redeemer or as rock? So the Son does appear to be in great movement. It appears to be a Redeemer in the sense that it's dark and then here comes the Son and everything's going to be fine. It changes everything and it's all good. Like, it's warm. It's like everything comes back to life. But then, you know, this goes back to our modern understanding, which I think actually helps us in this case. The Son is the most stationary thing we know. Like, we can't really perceive the movement of the Son the way we can perceive the movement of so many other things. The Son's movement actually comes from us moving around it. Like, it is such a rock, even though it seems like it's moving.
Yeah, locally, you know, we move around it. At a broader level, it is also moving, but it, like I said before, it drags us along with it wherever it goes. So both like relative to it specifically, but to this broader path that it's taking, we are constrained to go with it where it goes. And there is this mixture of, I guess, movement and non-movement, or movement and fixedness or fixity, or I don't know.
Yeah. It's like, it has to be both in some senses. Like the sun has words, the sky has words, God has words, but now we have words too, some way. And the sun and the sky have their words, and they go about their proclamation every day. God's words are always there. So what do we have to say in response? Like, there's this world outside of us every morning, and that world is waking up and being reborn. So who are we in relation to that? And Emu pointed out that it helps explain why one prays Shacharit at a certain time. He says you're not supposed to pray Shacharit too late after the sun has risen, or you kind of miss the point of it. There's this party happening and you're going to be a part of the conversation, or you miss the conversation. And Foreman said that halakhically, that's actually true. Halak is like the walk, like how you live things out. Halakhically, he says, some argue that it's more important to pray on time than it is to pray with a quorum. So it's better for you to wake up early and pray with the sunrise alone than it is to pray with people sometime later. So I think the question we had at the beginning of the episode is, are you listening? Mm,
yes.
And now this question that I have at the end is, will we join in the proclamation?
Yeah, that's good. I like that. I was thinking about how a day starts at sunrise when you are up with the sun, if you're one of those people that does that. That moment of sunrise for me is often a moment of silence, of listening. There is something about it that just naturally evokes a stillness. And are you listening? And then, I think there really is something to the sort of early morning prayers and not doing it when it's too late, because as the world kind of gets back up and gets going, you are going along with it now as a voice, I think, proclaiming when the first part is spent, are you listening? But I love that. I love those two questions in that order. Are you listening? Are you proclaiming? Yeah, that's good.
Well, so much for the short episode that I thought I had planned, Reed.
Ha! It's not just me. That was great, Reed. I love it when you're... Yeah. I love going on a drive when you're in the driver's seat.
Well, you know, in that metaphor, I do love driving, so I don't know. Maybe I should do this more often, I guess, but... Yeah. Okay. Well, I would definitely encourage people, if they have an Aleph Beta subscription, like, check out this little conversation. It's 40 minutes. It's less than what we put out. And yeah, there's just all sorts of little tidbits that like Foreman's commenting on as he's going through this thing. So I tried to like distill it down to the things that like helped me understand and move forward with a more complete view of Psalm 19, but I think there's a lot there. So yeah, check it out, explore it. And of course, pick up some Beekner while you're at it, huh?
Yeah, baby.
So you can go to bamautosamship.com to find those show notes and all the other stuff that you might need to get connected or find resources or whatever. So thanks for joining us on the Bama Podcast. We'll talk to you again soon.